Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hello and welcome to Unfiltered. My name is Ollie Dugmore and my guest today is a musician. Born in Mullingar Island in 1993, his life was normal. By the age of 16, he was one of the most famous people in the world. Part of the biggest boy band since the Beatles, One Direction. Reflecting on that moment, he said, "My childhood was cut short. I never really got the chance to finish school. After the first audition, I packed up everything in my life in a bag. I didn't realise at the time that when I was stuffing clothes into a little suitcase, that was pretty much me leaving home for good." His dad says he went to that audition and never came back. My guest today is Niall Horan. How's it going, pal?
Hello. Hello, Ollie. That was a hell of an intro.
You reckon?
Yeah, very good. We're off to a cracking start.
The vibes are just immaculate.
Yeah, we should just leave it there.
We'll stop. Job done. What have you been up to? What have you been up to the last few days? How are you keeping?
Good, yeah. I just got into Dublin today, doing the rounds and the promotional run. I got an album coming out in June, so I'm doing all the bits and pieces for that and doing a bit around Europe and, yeah, just been busy.
Gearing up for tour, and I think your sort of summer live festival debut is on the way as well.
Yeah, I played my first festival ever in May.
Big moves.
Yeah, and then...
How are you feeling about it?
Good. No, I can't wait, because I love a festival myself. I love going to them. I love the idea of like walking past the stage, seeing a band that you've never seen before, half cut.
Yeah, yeah. And then convincing that person to stay and listen to your music.
Yeah, so that's going to be my challenge. There will be people there that know exactly who I am and will be fans, I'd imagine, down towards the barrier. And then hopefully the idea is to get a few more drunken lads on the way to get a burger or something. That's the aim.
And that'll be your third album. I tried to sort of do the numbers on what you've sold since going solo. I could only find sort of the American ones are like very reliable, but it was like 6.5 million copies, I think, sold in the States since you went solo. Really, really impressive. How are you finding the experience of writing your own songs and sort of having that full creative control? I'm guessing really fulfilling.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, I've got a good record label where I get left to it, so I kind of like I tell them when I'm finished, kind of thing, which is, from what I gather, quite rare. But I've always been quite lucky. Yeah, I just kind of disappear there for a year, 18 months, get in the studio, get the head down, and then in October, November last year, I just went, okay, here, record label, it's yours now, and then they set it all up and we go for it. But yeah, no, it's exciting. It's an album that I spent a lot of time on. I think you can hear this, you know, when you like, I don't know if you can hear it, but you can tell, I can hear time in some people's records. Like when I listen to music, it's like they definitely thought about that. They took their time over it. They stewed on it. And I feel like I can hear that in this stuff, and I'm really excited for it. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Yeah. That's brilliant. So as with all of our guests on Unfiltered, this is a show about how the events of your life made you the person that you are today.
Yeah.
It seems... Well, let's begin at the beginning, which I think is always sensible.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
It's a good way to go. So, born in Mullingar.
Yeah.
My only common reference point for that is the Rubber Bandits song, Horse Outside, at the end.
It does get references, doesn't it?
So, I mean, tell me about Mullingar. What's good?
Small market type town, typical, very typical Irish looking town, kind of working class. 30 at the time, there was probably 35,000 people. It's probably a lot bigger now, I'm sure. These towns seem to get wider and wider every time, every year. But yeah, just a very small working class town in a smack bang in the middle of Ireland. Parents, my mother worked at a Mullingar Pewter, which is like a crafts, Irish crafts place, and my dad worked in Tesco for 35 years, and yeah, and then they divorced when I was four or five. And then I kind of jumped between houses. And
how was that for you? Because four or five, you're kind of, can you remember it?
Yeah, I can remember it happening, but obviously not really knowing what the hell was going on. Yeah. But yeah, I think being that young, I didn't know enough about it for to affect me.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Or so you think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no,
I'm so affected. Yeah, no, but it's one of those things. I'm still so young and not like impressionable at that point.
Mm.
So I'm completely good.
Yeah, it happened to me. My parents split when I was about 10, and so I was more conscious of kind of the relationship between them and how you can kind of end up, I guess, as a bit of a port. Not saying this happened to me, but you can kind of, as a child, feel a bit like responsible. And if I make this decision because it's more convenient for me, am I upsetting one of my parents?
Exactly.
But then as you get older, you kind of become more independent compared to your mates because you're only being surveilled by one adult.
Correct.
Instead of two. So you've got to get away with a bit more as well.
That's very, very true. Christmas is a tough one.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it depends, I guess, because you get two Christmas dinners.
Yeah, but jumping between is just a pain.
Yeah, for
sure. I'm going there this year, I'm going there next year. It's like
Yeah,
I was just
rotors.
Forever pleasing.
Mm.
But yeah, kind of gotten to the point now where it's just happens.
Do you remember the first time you performed, not necessarily musically, but the first bit of performance you did?
Christ. Yeah, I was probably like the choir teacher at school in our little, like I went to a primary school of about 200 or 300 kids, tiny little like rural school. And there was a woman in there, Anne Caulfield, and she was one of my teachers, and she also played piano and did all the choir stuff at Christmas carols and all that stuff. And she kind of heard me sing one day and then had me like sing, you know, solos and some of these little Christmassy things. And then she got me to play Oliver in the production of Oliver Twist when I was about 7. I think it was 7 or 8 probably. And that was like my first playing a lead role at that young, in such a big role like Oliver or whatever. So that was probably the first thing I can really remember. And then it was just kind of, she would always just kind of put me forward for things, you know, trying to build confidence to, you know.
Did a good job.
she did all right, didn't she? She's brilliant. I still talk to her today.
Awesome. How were you at school generally? Well behaved?
I was a combination. I think I was a bit of a messer, a bit of a class clown, but like a B, C, D student. I was never going to like take over the academic world, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I was a mixed bag. Never going to take over the academic world. Had a bit of a laugh, enjoyed school, and then, yeah, that's the way I was. Yeah, I was a bit of a messer. Yeah.
So often it is. There's people have a teacher. It could be like, I'm thinking probably of Ian Wright. You know, Mr. Pigeon, that PE teacher who sort of like made it for him.
How good was that?
Yeah,
that video
when they see each other for the first time.
Oh my god, please
made me cry. That
goosebumps now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He goes, I thought you were dead.
Yeah, I know.
It's like, I'm not.
I'm not, Ian. I'm here. Was your choir teacher a similar type of role? Was that your favourite teacher? Did the development you had really left an impact on you?
Yeah, probably, because our school, any school basically in Ireland, is very sports-centric, very like Gaelic football, very, you know, yeah, like very big, like a lot based around this. Maybe less so primary school. Primary school is primary school. You know, you're teaching kids how to add, to multiply, and draw a few pictures. Like, it's not overcomplicated, but not that I'm undermining anything that they did. they made me.
No, for sure.
But you know what I mean? It's not, you know. So you have teachers nurture at that age, whereas as students of an older age just annoy teachers.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, I think she just kind of took me under her wing with a couple of the other lads in our class and just kind of made me the singer when everyone else was all sporty and I didn't really play the Gaelic. I was too small to play Gaelic football. They were all big and strong, and I was just never grew. So I just kind of stuck to the singing.
Were your family musical?
No, not at all.
Liked music?
Yeah, big yeah. music fans. Yeah, like I grew up on a lot of like 70s American rock.
You could hear it.
Yeah,
in your work, yeah.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, well, that's a good thing, I suppose. It's kind of at this point, it's like subconscious. You kind of pick up the guitar, and that's what I naturally play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and having heard, that's I went to an Eagles concert when I was four. It was like my first gig at the RDS.
That's sick.
And I think that was like my intro to music and mm-hmm. like vinyl in the house and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, that was. They were all both mad into it and had like an amazing vinyl collection. In the house, so I was brought up on the good stuff. Still listen to it now, like there's no, it's the groundwork for what I do.
And your dad as well, in terms of other passions, massive Derby fan, right?
Massive Derby County fan, yeah, he's over there every week. Honestly, he's unbelievable, that fella. He, most weekends he's over there.
Mm. You go as well?
I try, yeah, when I go, yeah, I was at Oxford United a couple of weeks ago, been down to Portsmouth this season on a Friday night in the freezing cold.
how does a family living in Mullingar end up going to Pride, well, maybe not Pride Park initially.
Baseball ground, yeah. Yeah, back then.
What's the story there? How does that happen?
I think when he was born in 60, so 71, 72, he started getting into football, and we had won the league with Brian Clough, and it was, at that point, it was literally Derby or Leeds, and he probably would have still been listening to it on the wireless or something, and just kind of formed his opinion on English football through that, and then just whatever money he was making, he was going, trying to get over at least a couple of times a season or whatever. And then it snowballed into a passion where we'd go. There was a period when we were going nearly every weekend. Not an awful lot of money, bear in mind. He was like bringing us on, you know, a Tesco wage. And he was mad into it. And then you realise there's a load of Irish people who support Derby, and then it became a bit of like a, you know, the Irish Rams would turn up at Dublin Airport on a Saturday morning, or for years we went on the ferry.
I bet there were some good piss-ups there.
Oh, great. Yeah, well, I sadly wasn't involved in any of them when I was that age, but it looked like good crack.
Yeah.
But it was brilliant. We used to get like the stupid o'clock ferry at like 6 a.m. from Dunleary to Holyhead, and then get the train as the sun was coming up to Crewe and change at Crewe, and then Crewe to Derby, and then literally at 10 to 5 out the door, straight to back onto the train, Crewe, the reverse.
That's extraordinary.
And
commitment.
And he's still at that now. Well, obviously then Ryanair came about.
So it changed. The mechanics have been changed a little bit.
East Midlands Airport became the spot. And then, he's still at it every other week. He was there at the weekend watching us get thumped 2-0 against Forest Green Rovers or something like that. So it's
not quite the
It's gone
days.
Beyond football fandom now. Yeah, it's just it's a thing.
Masochism.
Mm-hmm.
Your childhood and education was cut short, like I said at the top of this in the introduction, by One Direction and the X Factor.
The bastards.
Damn it! God, I really hate those guys for that.
Yeah. I can't believe they took me out of school.
Rolling Stone call One Direction, and this is a direct quote, one of the great rock and roll bands of the 21st century.
I'll take that. Sarcastic.
A little bit. With hindsight, obviously, think you can make comments like that, but at what point did you sort of sit up and go, hang on, there's something happening here, you know, this isn't what my other 16 year old mates are at?
It was because it was so quick, but gradually quick. It felt, because there was no, like, I can't think of a specific moment, but it was like that, but when you're in the mix, a short period of time feels like a long period of time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And you're in the bubble going along with it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember just like going to the States for the first time in 2000 and probably 11 or 12, and seeing like the madness for a country we'd never been to before.
Yeah.
And like, you know, in our head, from our neck of the woods, it's America's the thing, isn't it? You know?
Mm-hmm.
We were seeing it outside the X Factor studio, and we were seeing bits around the UK, and because, you know, they know us because we're on their TV screens every Friday night or every Saturday night. And then it was just getting to the States and like seeing that madness, or going to like places like Italy and the streets being blocked off and like shutting down Times Square and like you know, like mad stuff.
Yeah.
That's when you're like, what's going on?
I think the point you made there on about being on TV as well, because, you know, when the show was in its peak around then, I think it was getting about 15 million people watching it every night, right? So you go from being a normal teenager, it gets broadcast, 15 million people all of a sudden know exactly who you are. Yeah. You know, they've done the emotional backstory thing. They've built you up. Yeah. They've done all that.
Yeah.
You're going through the show and by Sunday, you're famous, you know? I guess this is kind of what you mean by quick and gradual.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it difficult to adjust?
Yes and no. Like, the fact that I literally, like, packed a suitcase and never went home.
Mm.
14 years later, still the same thing. Like, that was mad. But then again, I'd watched The X Factor for years. I was just, like, going along with it. Like, this is brilliant. To meet these new lads. We're having a great time. I was 16 or 17 or something like that. Just being 16 and 17, very impressionable. Just going along with things. Seeing what happens, playing it by ear, having fun, making tunes. Like, it was all just happening. And I was there.
Well, I was more than there, playing myself down a little bit, yeah. But I guess it's kind of like a continuation of school, maybe, in a way. But you like you were saying, making tunes. And yeah, you made some tunes. 5 years, 5 records, 4 world tours, 2 of which were arena tours. The thing that impresses me, one of the things that most impresses me about it, is the work ethic that involves. And actually, at the beginning, you mentioned time.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned being able to listen to a record and hear time.
Yeah.
What was the story with that work ethic? Were you making hay while the sun shines? You were like, we're having a great time here. Let's go, let's go, let's go. Did you want to be working that hard and intensively?
That's why you kind of stop for a second, because, like, it was just that we've done a lot here. Maybe just, like, everyone calm down for a second. But it's not so much striking while the iron's hot. It's more the demand is there. Like, we can go and we can play, like, 2 years of stadiums, like, which is nuts. And at that point, not a lot. Like, it was U2, basically. And there wasn't many, like, people playing stadiums around then. And it was just the demand was there, and it was fun. It was a great laugh. We were just bouncing around the place on a bus, going all over the world, seeing different places, getting up on stage to countries that don't even speak the same language as you.
And they're singing the words back at you.
Yeah, we remember the first time we went to South America. We played in Bogota, Colombia, first night. Never been in the place in our lives. Never been to South America. And we played to like 50,000 people on the first night. People that don't even speak the same language as you, and they're roaring lyrics back. And I always just find that, like, that's the maddest thing about what we do. But I remember seeing that as well. That was another point where I was like, Christ, this is a different league. This is nuts. Yeah.
This is serious.
Yeah.
that's I mean, that's completely, completely extraordinary. You're saying there's a lot of demand. So obviously, you know, a lot of sales. Mm. I'm thinking of myself at that time, 16, 17, 18 year old me, getting a payday like that. Mm-hmm. And I'd be thinking, well, I'll put it like this: I wouldn't be buying premium bonds. I'd be doing something a bit silly with my money. And I just wonder, was there a moment, you know, like, you know, there's a moment where you go, "Oh my god, this is massive," and you get that first big paycheck. Do you spend it on something a little bit ridiculous, or were you kind of doing the Stormzy thing and buying your mum a house and all that?
Yeah, no, I did that. Bought my mother a house. Did pay the mortgage off first. Yeah. That was the first one.
Brilliant.
Did I get it? I think I might have got my mother a car. She was driving like a Daewoo something, and I got her a car. Things like that, yeah.
There's something in me as a son that just makes me want to do that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, being able to offer, it's like such a good thank you. Do you know what I mean? Pay it back.
Literally dragged me up. no, I was brought up. I wasn't dragged up. But you know, being able to do that stuff is class. Like, coming from a small working class town, knowing how tough it is to raise families and stuff like that, and then being able to, like, do stuff like that is pretty sweet. Then, you know, I was able to get myself a flat, and, like, I always, like, I feel like such a prick. People ask me, like, what was the first car you had? I was like, do I have to tell you?
Yeah, you do. Now
I got a Range Rover for my first car.
Yes. Colour, what, like, white? Yeah, gold?
No, it was black, and I had it fucking matted. Yeah. And I was rolling around London like, just yeah. Look at this guy. Yeah, but like
6x9s in the back.
Yeah, oh fun. Yeah, we were rolling big on 22s, baby. but it was just like, it's such a, and I, it was, it's not so much I'm going to splash the cash.
No,
well, I have, like, a, you know, I was brought up well, you know, we got, we're we've done all right with the money thing, and you know, I'm going to get myself a car.
Yeah,
I can, and
you've earned it.
I'm going to learn how to drive here and
in this car.
Yeah, I'm going to learn how to drive.
And then, insurance.
No,
I got
test in Barnet in. You know, High Barnet, whatever. Yeah, yeah. There's a testing centre up there. Some Irish fella taught me how to drive, which sounded dodgy enough already. And then, and I remember I never did a manual test.
Right.
I did an automatic test because I noticed that all the cars that, like, you can get every car in automatic. I was like, why would I put myself through that?
Yeah.
I knew I have to drive a tractor. then I just started, I never did a manual test, did the automatic. Yeah, and so I got myself a car, was able to get myself a flat. And they were kind of my big spends.
You were talking about that show in Bogota, and I saw you guys play. It was the BBC Music Awards, so it was loads of different artists. I think you did one song maybe, and
Coldplay, I remember.
In the crowd, at the mention of the name One Direction, right? And obviously, every other artist was a bit of applause.
God's
and clap. Yeah, exactly, which you know about. And then your name gets mentioned, and the sound that the crowd created is unlike anything I've heard anywhere else. Mm. It's so hard to describe. It's like visceral. It's like this instinctive thing. Mm. And I just wonder, as you know, a young man.
I'm deaf now.
You've been doing well pretending to hear me. As a young man, you walk on stage, there's 50,000 Colombians, and I imagine the noise was more extreme than there was the BBC Music Awards, which is a bit more sedate affair.
Yeah.
How does it feel to hear that noise? And it's directed at you, do you know what I mean?
You know, I'm one of these people that I've never, ever gotten bored of, like, the feeling. Some people are like, I could do without touring. I could go home. You know, touring's not for me, but I've always been excited for every show. Like, what you're going to get, the tension, the fact that people have waited and paid like mad money to come and watch it. I've like live off that. And that when whatever the start of the show may be, when that starts and the lights go down or whatever, hearing that sound is just like, there was talk of it being like the same sound as if you were to set off. If NASA were to launch a rocket in the middle of the stadium, is what?
Well, like the
decibel level is the same noise as like fucking Soyuz or something. Like, there was talk of that at a few gigs. It's probably more so in South America, very loud for the passionate country. You know? that feeling is just like it's goose pimples every time.
I bet.
If you get bored of that, there's something wrong with you.
How do you stay calm? You're in the wings.
Mm.
That happens.
You just look at each other and just laugh. Like, we would like, there was so many, we actually called one of our stadium tours Where We Are Tour because we would just be all the time just going, look where we are.
Yeah.
Like, we'd literally be just going, what is this? This is mental. So we would literally, it was a laughable offence what was going on. Mm. Like, there was, you couldn't, you know, if you didn't laugh, you'd cry.
Yeah.
That phrase, you know.
Diffuse it.
So yeah, there was a lot of times where we just stand there just going, what the fuck is going on? This is, how did we manage this?
It's insane. Yeah. I mean, so coming at it from a sort of, you know, ego perspective, right? Mm. You've got that noise every time you walk out on stage. You've got people queuing for days, you know, to get into your gig. I think you still got that now. I was reading a review from one of your earlier shows in The Guardian. I think it interviewed people who had been there for 2 days, right, waiting for you so they could be at the front.
Mm.
You've got all this going on. And again, I keep going back to how young you were at this time. How did you stay level-headed? How did you try and keep your ego in check? You seem so normal now talking to you, and it's just, it's extraordinary.
I don't know. I do get that, but I don't know. I don't really know how.
Yeah.
I suppose, like, having good people around. I was actually asked about this a couple of days ago. The answer is probably the people around, like, the managers, the label, just the people we had in our team, our tour managers are important, our security are important. People like that are very important to things like that. And then it's, I'd say most likely our background, like the way we were brought up. I think that was half the attraction of One Direction, was that people could clearly tell it was five working class young lads from market towns and villages all over the UK and Ireland, and they were just like deer in the headlights, pop stars, you know. I think that was what a lot of people were attracted to. And you just have to, we just kept just going along with it, seeing what had happened, and not, because we, it's probably because we had each other, I think. There's that thing of being able to keep each other in check, but I can't remember any situations of anyone being like over their station or whatever, if that's even a phrase.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd say most likely down to our upbringings, I'd imagine.
Mm.
Brought up, not dragged up.
Was there anyone in particular, I don't know, who was able to guide you, whether it was another artist or maybe a particular manager or someone in your security that, you know, in, let's say in a particularly stressful situation or whatever, you would be able to go to and be able to give you a bit of advice and give you a bit of a steer on how you should handle something? Because, you know, when I was that age, I'd go and talk to one of my parents about it. You're on the other side of the world.
Right? Yeah. There was that. The parents were helpful, though, because you'd just have normal conversation.
Yeah.
And they were blown away by it, too. So the fact that they were all blown away, it was like, oh, talk to my granny. And she's like, oh, I just cut your 95,000 picture out of the paper. You know, like, you still had that. And it was still, you know, it was exciting to hear that. So that brings you down to earth straight away when you hear that kind of thing. And the parents' situation was always good because it was like very simple conversation, nothing, very Irish. Oh, did you hear who died this week in Mullingar? Like, you know, like that's the kind of thing that...
I shouldn't be laughing at
that. Yeah, I know, that's but rude. That's the kind of, that's where the conversation starts most of the time. But yeah, I think it was just the simplicity of the conversation. And like, I remember like my father and my mother saying like, you know, we've got no idea about this industry at all. You know, you already know more about that, like now. And but you know, just stay grounded. Don't let you get ahead of yourself or anything like that. And you know, because I think you probably spend your whole career, in no matter what it is, you're trying to, like, you're nearly holding on, like as if it's on its way out. Yeah. You know, you're like, that's the way we kind of we think as people. It's human nature to either get ahead of yourself and it falls flat on its face, or you like are grabbing on it's going, and it's probably not. But yeah, there's a bit of that that keeps you humble. Like when we were doing stadiums back in the day, and even now when I'm like playing arenas and things like that, it could be very easily gone. Like there's another young, you know, another. There's some young sexy fella coming up here now just like...
Impossible. Impossible.
You know, and you have to think about what's coming and how competitive it is out there. And if you, you know, there's thoughts that go through your head, you know, that keep you humble anyway.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Did it change, has your success, maybe not with your parents, but I was listening to an interview, I think it might have been Wan-Bissaka or someone like that, and he was talking about when he got his first team debut, when he was starting for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the senior pros said to him, this weekend you're going to get a lot of people reaching out to you, you're going to get a lot of people being like, oh, let's go for a drink, let's do this, do that. And he's like, don't, stay yourself, like stay within your zone, stay with the people that matter to you. How did it change... From that perspective, your relationships with other people, how did success change that part of you, that part of your life?
Yeah, there were definitely some strange ones. Not that I could particularly put my finger on, you just get a feeling. Like people that you went to school with that you barely spoke to, you know, that wouldn't even look at you in the hallway or now pretending to... like
kicking the shit out of you.
Yeah, or like spinning you around with your bag on your back and like, you know, doing a bit of all that stuff. You remember when we were at that house party? And remember? I was like, no, I don't really know. I was 15, 16. A lot of that. And then, like, yeah, you get, like, family asking you to get, like, autographs signed and tickets for this person and videos for that person's nephews, cousins, you know, all that kind of stuff. But that's kind of slowed down a lot. I think the excitement of, you know, it all was a bit much for everyone. There are definitely, like, there are definitely, like, relationships that are, yeah, silently fractured without, you know.
When you're, when you are in that, that level of, I guess, fame, right? This sounds like a stupidly broad question, but, like, what happens? What, like, what is, in the terms of, like, the details of your life, what changes? You know, have you got someone who is, like, a PA or whatever, who is really there for any need you have, they help you out? Is it, like, body doubles going out of different entrances to hotels?
I've done all of that, yeah.
You've done all that?
I've done decoyed, like, vans and...
Yeah. So how does it change, like, the logistics of your life? Because I'm assuming now, I don't know, do you, are you able to sort of, like, walk and go and get a pint of milk or go for a pint and all that kind of stuff? Like, what changes for someone who hasn't experienced it? What?
Yeah, I think the height of 1D, in hindsight, I probably could have gone more places. But the fear of going somewhere and getting pictures and autographs every step, because there was periods where you'd go out and you wouldn't get 5 yards outside the door and it'd be cars pulling over on the street and countryside, or you go into the pub and everyone is looking at you, or anything. I remember one time I went to Westfield in Shepherd's Bush and honestly swore to God, I was like, I'm going to die in here. I'm never getting out of here.
Outside, there's more people coming to Westfield. They're swarming.
It's like Shaun of the, it's like Shaun of the Dead or something. But yeah, no, I remember, like, it was probably the fear of that kept me in, and I probably became a bit of a recluse in ways. Early doors, probably I'd say 2012, 13, that kind of world. 14 maybe as well, where it was just kind of, yeah, it was probably all in my head. Like, became a recluse because of the thought of going out when I probably could have. Because in hindsight now, I literally live the most normal, like, life that I could possibly live in the scenario I'm in. You know, I, like, do my, like, I could go, I know this is sounding stupid because there was a period where I couldn't do any of this, but go to the shops and buy my own stuff and make my own dinner and do, you know, do the washing when I need to, and you know, just general stuff. Like, there was a period where if someone said to me, do you want to grab a coffee or do you want to go for lunch, I would have said absolutely not. And now, like, you know, was I right to have been so quiet and reclused? You know, with hindsight's a wonderful thing. But yeah, I have an assistant, like, you know, with helps me with day to day stuff, calendar management, house things, you know, general stuff. And that's very helpful, obviously, because I'm on the move all the time, and, you know, be disaster if I just turned the key in the house and that was it. I come back to a pit of the dust. But yeah, no, like, that's, that kind of thing's great. And I used to, like, have security every single place I went, and it, you know, there'd be someone standing there all the time. And I just was like, I don't need it. I grew up and went, I can actually deal with this myself. Do you know, I can, like, if someone comes up to me and asks for a photo, and a few people do, it's just like, yep, just, like, you know, you get used to things.
Most people are decent, right? Like, most people just want to, like, say hello to you a lot of the time, I guess. And I just like to, the word you use there, fear. That's a really powerful word to talk about something that I think a lot of people would just immediately think, well, what's to complain about? You know, it's like, it's such a good thing. But to use that word, it's clearly, like, a really deep feeling that you had at the time. And it kind of, like you were saying, it's also self-fulfilling, you know, because you're scared, you don't go out because you're scared, and then you're just spiraling.
Snowball, no, you're right. It is. I don't know what I was fearing. Like, when I think about it, it's like, what was I fearful about?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there is that, like, and people are okay. Like, that's fine if they have that view, you know, you're rich and famous and that must be brilliant, you know. But there is a side of it when you've just come from zero to hero, for the want of a better phrase. you know, the shock of it, you know, one day you're not, and then you are, then the next day, and it's just like a bit, it's a bit of a shock to the system, and you just kind of, you're trying to be as, live a normal life, and the stuff that comes with it is a bit of like, oh, fuck, I wasn't expecting this. Yeah, there's just, it's, they're human feelings, but fair enough, people have that view or whatever, but I've lived it, and I just kind of know what it's, obviously there are great perks as to what I do, but there was a couple of times where I was a bit, not all the time, by the way, I sound like I was like depressed in what I was doing, I wasn't, I was loving it, but a couple of little things that I would have loved to have, would have loved to have done different, maybe.
Did you grow up at all during this time? And I don't mean that to sound rude as it does. I mean it sincerely, because simultaneously you're talking about the kind of the machinery that surrounds you at that time, right? And as a 16, 17, 18-year-old guy, I think of myself, right? I made mistakes.
Yeah,
I made a lot of mistakes. I got to make them in private. I didn't have the glare of the Daily Mail pointing at me. I didn't have all of these people around me, like this apparatus that exists, I guess, to insulate you in a way, but also, like you said, to sort of take care of you, help you, assist you with all the stuff that's going on. So what did that mean for you and your kind of, development and like growing up?
Yeah, it was obviously a very different formative years to most people. We were in a bubble, and we were just, the circus was going into towns and leaving it, and there was people around doing stuff. We just probably had to grow up quicker. Like, as you said, you probably got to make some of your mistakes in private. I don't know if I made a ton of mistakes, but if I did, I did them publicly, probably. And that's a very different thing for a 17, 18-year-old to deal with. I've always been a bit carefree and just kind of gone with it. With everything, to be honest with you.
I get that vibe from you.
Yeah, I just like, well, I'm not a bad person, I don't think. I might have made a few mistakes, fair enough, and that's that. We all do that. And I could live with that and just going plodding along, taking every day as it comes. But yeah, probably subconsciously, because the shielding and that we had to do, you know, in our lives if we wanted any sort of privacy, it probably matured you in a way that you didn't realise. And probably some parts of my emotions or whatever probably got left behind for a couple of years, and I'm probably catching up still. I don't know. We're yet to find out. This is Ollie, my therapist.
We're going deep, man.
Wait to see us in the pub in about an hour.
My therapy is just, an over-reliance on alcohol as like an emotional crutch instead of actually dealing with any of the shit in my head. okay, so let's move on then. The actual moment, 1D comes to an end. When did you realise that it was over?
There was a chat about a year out. Maybe less. I was just like, right, after this run, we'll just take it easy for a bit. We were all, like, as I said, there was so much done in a short period of time. And people always used to say, well, you're young, you can do it. You know, you're spring chickens. But for anyone, that's intense. You know, such a life shift. So much going on a different level. I think it was just kind of like, right, let's slow down for a sec.
You described it as, I've seen you describe it in the past as a madness, or as madness. So what comes after madness? Is there a calm after the storm? Like, how did you spend the time immediately afterwards?
Straight away, we finished in December, and I was in Australia on January the 2nd. A cousin of mine was living down there, and he was leaving. He'd spent 5 or 6 years down there.
It was December 31st, wasn't it, your last show?
December, probably mid-December. Oh, okay. It was mid-December, I think it was. And then I was like home for Christmas. And then my cousin was leaving. He was living in Australia for 5 years in Melbourne. And he was leaving to move back. And he literally packed up his bag. He sold his golf club, sold his bed, sold his blah, blah, blah. And packed his whole life into one bag after 5 years. And then we met him in Australia. And then we went up through Southeast Asia, just the three of us, and just stayed in dump hotels and hostels and just had a great laugh. It was brilliant. Such a good laugh.
You found yourself?
I found myself, yeah. It was deep, man. Show you my tattoos later.
Really deep. Okay. So what was it like performing for the first time?
Yeah.
by yourself.
Strange, yeah. I remember the first thing I did was, I think the first thing I did was Graham Norton. And I just remember like sitting in the dressing room, and usually there'd be like a period where someone's out smoking a cigarette, someone's gone to the toilet 2 seconds before we go on stage, we're now late. So I just sit in the couch and wait for it. And I remember going, I'm not waiting for anyone. I could go on my own time. Do you know what I mean? I remember that being the feeling. You know, when they call you, you're like, I've got 5 minutes, lads. You're like, well, he's in the toilet. He's out the back door smoking a cigarette. You know, we'll wait. So I remember that being the thing, and then getting to stage and just looking around and there's less people. But apart from that, I just always trust myself as like a performer. So I just had to go and do it. But definitely different. Wouldn't say strange. I wouldn't say... Just a different experience, not really comparable.
As a man of the same age, in fact, it turns out the exact same age as you.
Shut up.
We're born on the same day.
What?
Yeah, I know. There's multiple parallels happening here. I know, small world. Yeah, crazy. Yeah.
13 September.
Yeah, man.
93,
yeah.
Shut your mouth.
Yeah. I don't, what time were you born?
8 a.m.
7 a.m.
Oh.
An hour older, my guy. Sorry, I've just grown about a couple of inches there.
That is... nuts. Crazy, I've never met anyone
that's mad,
from the 13th.
Yeah, anyway, so what I was...
You've got a much stronger beard than I'd ever be able to pull off.
You're laying it on thick, Niall. Thank you. I appreciate it. But what I was going to say was, mate, like, I think about myself and how I conceive of myself and my career, and I think I'm 29. I reckon my peak is in my future. Mm-hmm. And in your situation, reaching the heights that you reached, mm-hmm, in One Direction, to then go solo... and kind of be standing on that cliff.
Mm.
I just imagine the pressure. And that can either manifest itself as a really heavy pressure or possibly also as an anxiety.
Mm.
And to hear you describe you playing for the first time like that, I would have thought there'd be this, you know, crazy burden on your shoulders. I don't know.
I think if the song was shite, I would have been a bit more nervous. And that's the God's honest truth. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I remember writing it going, all right, this will do for now. This might get me somewhere. It's a lot easier to stand up on a stage when you've written a good one. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think so anyway. There definitely was like, I just had to trust in what I thought I was good at, which is writing tunes and performing. And I felt like I could just keep doing it. Luckily enough, had the fan base there.
Mm.
So I knew I wasn't walking into a dark room. You know, it was going to be somewhat, you know, strong. And then thankfully I've had a couple of songs that have done well, and, you know, I've been able to play do some amazing stuff. But there was definitely a period of like, geez, I need to get it right first time around. There's probably no second go at this, you know. I'll just be forgotten about. But I didn't think about that too much, to be honest. That would have been a very easy hole to fall into.
So why?
I am nothing without this, you know, like I just trust in myself.
Why do you think you didn't fall into that hole then? Where's that? I guess you'd say self-belief, but obviously you've been incredibly successful, so you would believe in yourself, right, I guess. But.
Yeah, I don't know. You can't really put your finger on it. You can just roll with the punches, and I trusted that I had a decent album, and I worked with similar people, and I knew what I wanted to write about, and it was all kind of there in front of me, and I had to kick the ball into the goal. Thankfully, I did, and the fan base is a massive part of that.
Mm.
Like, being able to go around the world, you know, is helpful.
It's awesome.
It's cool, you know, it is. It's amazing that, you know, I can go most places in the world and play a gig. It's phenomenal. I realize how lucky I am, but knowing that, helps, you know, like, as I said, I'm not walking into a dark room. People will listen. It's now about gathering momentum and still doing that, to be honest with you. It's still like 3 albums in and a pandemic later. You know, you're still trying, it's so competitive out there. You're competing again. I'm really competitive with myself about writing the next best song. And then there's the other singers that are out there competing with you, and you're trying to, you know,
and your old bandmates, I guess.
Yeah, and them boys as well. But there's no, like, we're very good at that. We're not, like, because if we all made the same type of music, then maybe.
Mm.
I'd say there would be, like, a silent kind of, you know, dig here and there. But nah, we're very good at each other. It's like, yeah.
Have you watched Capaldi's Netflix doc?
No, I haven't got around to it yet, actually. But I'm also very good friends with him and aware of...
what he's gone through, right? Yeah. So, yeah, okay. What I'm coming at it from is I've watched an hour and a half of Netflix. You actually have being his friend. So, so you've got a much better idea of what I'm about to talk about than I do. But I was watching that and I just, you know, his extraordinary success and the way it kind of manifests and then morphs into this incredibly heavy burden and the pressure it put him under. And I wonder what the, maybe the, maybe not the point of difference, maybe there is a point of difference between the two of you, I don't know, but the way you've handled that pressure, why is it different? And then I guess because you're mates, if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about how you've kind of helped him and spoken to him about, I guess, your experience and how maybe that can inform how he's dealing with it.
Yeah, I think there are similarities. Two working class lads, two Celtic boys, you know, spring to fame, like Mike Richards once said. What did he say? What did he say? And Roy Keane said to him, what was his line? A shot onto the scene or something,
something like that.
I know, but you know what I mean. So, there are a lot of similarities.
Did you see Roy Keane just saying baby the other day?
No.
I can't remember who it was. There's a player. Terry, he goes, he's just a baby. He's just a baby. And then there's a pause and he goes, baby. And they all like collapsed in laughter. It was unreal. Absolutely unreal.
Nonsense. Yeah. It's a baby. No, there are definitely similarities. Myself and Capaldi, like the second I met him, we were just straight in, like good mates. Like I don't have a lot of, I don't particularly want any, but there's a lot of, you know, I think a lot of people think that famous people are all friends with famous people. Not necessarily the case. There's a lot of arseholes around there too. And me and Cavalli just happened to get on very well the minute we met, and similar taste in music, like a few pints, have a bit of a laugh, and we get on very well. And we have that similarity where we just kind of, it happened very fast for him. Like one minute he's... you know, just throwing a couple of YouTube videos and then he's playing arenas. Or just went to watch him in Atlanta, Georgia last week. Like he's, now he's an international star of his own. And that happened very quick for him with great music. So there we've definitely have that in common. Like I spoke to him the other day. He was on tour in Toronto and we were just shooting the shit and talking about like what it's like on the road and how long he's got left and how he's enjoying the shows and... We chat about that kind of stuff, and then we've had some darker conversations too, obviously, because that's what friends do. But I've always like felt like I've been there for him. He used to ask me like questions early on about this and that, and I just help wherever I could. But I can't. That's his anxieties and his mental health is something I obviously can't control. But I'll be there to calm him if I can. Oh, he's obviously got great parents, as you can see, and. They're just brilliant with him and all his mates, and he's got good folk around him. And we do have a lot in common, and I can help him wherever I can. I'm no genius either. There's no book for it, really, is there? But you just have to. I know a little bit.
Be a mate to him. Yeah. Do you think I just picked up on that? Then you talked about his friends from home, right? And they are just his. They're his mates, right? They're his mates from before he was famous. Yeah. Do you think there's something to be said for that? About, I guess, being friends with normal people, staying grounded, and also people who, just because I guess the pressure in your life, it can manifest in different ways. Maybe it's because you feel this pressure of success. Maybe it's pressure to pay your electricity bill. There's commonality there. And actually staying in touch with, not losing your mates because you think, oh, I'm better than them or whatever, what a deluded thing some people get into their heads. But actually keeping that support network and friendship circle can be so useful. For anyone from like a mental health perspective.
Oh, there's no doubt. Yeah. Fact, like I don't really have many new friends. I don't particularly need them or want them. all of my mates are from home, and like some lads have moved to London or whatever, and we spend a bit of time there too. But all of my mates, my best mate, he moved to America for work and we live together still. And since I've known him since I was four, we went to primary school together. It happened that way. And I'm glad it does. You know, it's like, it's very important, I think. You know, they're off doing their jobs. Like one of Lewis's mates is like a gravedigger, and his other mate works in finance, and the other fellow works in recruitment. And then my mates are, working property and, you know, just, yeah, like there's
normal lads.
Just normal lads doing, but it's all very relative. Like, it's not like I'm going around going, I don't pretend. I don't tend to talk about work a lot in front of them, to be honest, because like it's just, people, you know.
Most people don't. I don't know. Like, there's that classic thing of like you get down. Oh, you're all right. Yeah, you're all right. And then you're just like off talking about some absolutely nonsense, nonsense thing. You know what I mean?
Literally, by the way.
It's like, Gravedigger as well. You're saying, oh, I don't need any friends. I would love to become friends with a Gravedigger because I'd just be fascinated by that man.
Yeah,
that's extraordinary.
He's a great lad as well. But I think it is important. If it's not like I'm trying to keep in touch with my, you know, my old life. It's not like that. It's just that's the way it
just
is.
Just doing my bit for the community.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm not trying to like keep myself down to earth by forcing relationships with old friends, but no, I definitely like that's just the way it is. We're all still have the same interests in sport and drinking and there are the commonalities.
Always. Would you do it all again?
What?
If you had the choice. 16-year-old you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Says this is where you'll end up.
Yeah.
You get a choice. You can do it, you can't. You go somewhere else, some other way.
Yeah. Oh, no, 100%. Yeah. I've had a very good experience of it. I'm sure there are, like, you hear horror stories, don't you? I've never really met anyone with a mad horror story, but you do hear horror stories of they weren't looked after or they fell into a hole or, you know, like this. But I just don't know whether it's a character thing or the way I was brought up or I don't know, but I've just really loved all of it. I'm like, yeah, there's relative days where you're just a bit like, oh, fuck this, but we all have that. But I just love the madness. I wouldn't change much at all. Actually, I wouldn't change a thing. You learn from the mistakes and you go at it again. And I mean, the perks of what I do is just incredible. So I'm one of the very lucky few over the decades to be able to do what we do. So, no complaints from me. I wouldn't change a thing.
No, Horan, thank you so much for taking
your
time.
You're a gent, Ollie. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it, mate. Thank you.
Brilliant. What a fucking interview that was.
Happy?
That's the best one I've ever done.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.